What, the presentation? It's I'll tell you what, while we're doing that, we couldn't just see whether we can get a signal, just to check that it's not.
No.
Oh, okay.
Ah.
This video has got sound.
Yeah.
Talk about
Everything.
This one doesn't work.
Another laptop, but if none of them works,
okay, I think we're 10 because still too little audience and time. Yeah, to really try to make sure everybody knows that well.
Yes, I have the. Yeah, I've got it on a USB stick.
Okay.
Was there a pen?
Do you want a pen, mine?
Yeah.
Ah, smaller you there.
Oh, yeah.
We were just thinking about when to start.
Yeah, we were just wondering where. Yeah. Whether people were coming at 10 thinking it was 9 or what. You know.
So, me being here is some sort of.
They said, well, you want to put a 10.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's going to be a bit more than 10. We had a really big time. Around 5, you know.
Yeah, okay.
So, they might not make
it. Yeah, but it does.
But okay, then let's start at 10. It doesn't make sense otherwise. So.
Okay, maybe it's a problem of the. Yeah, now it's something that's going on.
Okay.
Right. Sure. If anyone sees a black pen that goes with a tablet,
it'd be a shame to lose it.
Yeah, no, I've got a pen drive. No, it's my tablet pen. Oh, there we go. Oh, here it is.
Right.
Right. The retaining to it is... What did you change?
It's because you're using laptop, so you shouldn't have to use.
Oh, okay.
We started 9:45. So
9:45.
Internally, sorry for the confusion, but
that's okay.
I've been trying to remember who is involved in that all weekend.
Yeah.
So it's you and
Joseph Jackson. It's Joseph's initiative, isn't it? And Brian Bishop, and Edward somewhere over.
Yeah. You know what?
That's all. Yeah.
I mean, what's wrong with it?
Well, it's a very low resolution PR, but
Maybe you can do this way.
Yeah, let's just see what, how it comes up.
Oh well, but no. I think the screen is completely there. But I don't know why it wasn't right. When I was at home, I hooked it up to an external monitor and it was outputting fine. I don't know if any different with that. Yeah. Can't even manage it in the conflicts where it's
you've got that kind of a bunch of Linux nodes.
Yeah. It was outputting at 102.168 on an external monitor. Fine. I suppose it's the Moore's rate of detection. It's not quite up to scratch. We'll start when Stefan comes back. Right, well, should we kick off? Together last night, in the back of my camper van. it was pretty cold last night. This morning I couldn't open the sliding door to get out of my van because it was frozen shut. It wasn't the most comfortable of evenings. Okay, so Postgres C3 open source design and advanced automation, the next phase of civilization. As Martian touched on yesterday, using similar language. So this is just distilled from my attempts at some holistic thinking around what's possible with open source design, but advanced automation and what resources we have to play with basically as a civilization. Going back to first principles and looking at the sort of latest technological knowledge that we have now, and just to be clear, what I'm talking about is kind of both transitional stuff, but also what we could potentially get to, and it's just kind of food for thought, really. So, comments welcome. So these are the subjects I'll just briefly go through: open source design, generally, tool chains. Fabrication, turning objects, advanced automation in terms of self-maintenance and repair and scalability and automated infrastructure, fundamental resources, our key fundamental resources that we have as a civilization: material, energy, information and intelligence. And then what that potentially might enable. Open source design, I think you're all pretty au fait with what that would be. It is a powerful and barely discovered process for designing physical objects and machines and systems in a new way that we know has been successful with complex software development. So complex hardware development, I think, is definitely possible for the right tools. It's a pretty nascent field. It's barely got started, but obviously we have a huge potential for that. It goes to the way that we produce goods, machines, systems, services. Making the leap from bits into atoms, and not only for the community items, but anywhere for large scale national infrastructure, that kind of thing, potentially. And I personally think, and maybe some of you do too, that it has the potential to supersede pretty much all commercial forms of production and type. So the reasons that it, some of the reasons that it doesn't really exist yet, I think, is partly the kind of tool chain needed to make development easy, not only from the point of view of creating the geometry and creating an object, but kind of working together and everything needed to go from an early idea to actual fabrication. Now, bits and pieces of those tools obviously do exist. There is some simple CAD software, there is CAM software available. But it's not particularly user-friendly or unified. If you've got someone who wants to get involved but is not particularly geeky, the barrier for entry is probably a little higher than that. So we can get that down. So user-friendly CAD, we want to get as many people involved in this as possible. All sorts of collaborative functions that you can imagine be built in, everything from working to sort of desktop screen sharing so you can look at the same thing while talking to each other, documentation of the project, easy access to a vast repository of reusable components and objects, which is pretty important and very obvious in this day and age, but so you can spend the majority of your time working on the novel aspects of your design rather than reinventing the wheel. We all know that's required. All sorts of analysis and simulation. There is a reasonable amount of analysis software, open source analysis software available. It's maturing. Easy access to CAM, both locally driving it directly, but also over the internet, maybe sending the files directly to companies that would send you back the parts. Depending on what it was, if it was personal fabrication, or if it was something larger that we make. There's already software, which you may be aware of, so that you can design objects on your machine and then press a button and it'll email the geometry to a mail order sort of fabrication company. E-machine shop is a good example of that. It's a fairly simple CAD system. Some would argue that maybe that's for simple fabrication of parts. E-machine shop, yeah. And they've got a free, not open source, but they've got a free CAD tool. The really nice thing about it is that when you make a part and you apply a material to it, and a fabrication process, it has the limitations of that fabrication process built into the CAD tool. So if you can build it in the CAD tool, they know that they can build it, which is pretty neat. And you'll get the parts back in a couple of weeks. They do everything from all the RP stuff, CNC, all the sheet material, cutting methods. So it doesn't really exist yet, and will be a huge bonus when it gets to the point where anyone who wants to engage in this can. And I think an interesting point to make is that CAD, 3D CAD, in some sense is more intuitive to other human beings than obscure computer code, potentially. Anyone can look at a screen and rotate an object and see what it's all about, whereas generally that's not the case with code, especially with other programs. So it may be, a higher percentage of people could potentially get involved in this than programs, perhaps. So how do we actually create these objects once we've designed them? There are some fundamental differences, obviously, with software, where you can compile or download a binary fairly easily. It's fairly obvious to say that at the moment, you know, you've got the expense of different materials, use of the machines, that sort of thing, and quite a slow process. It's not quite the same as tweaking a line and then recompiling. It's a little bit slower than that. But bits are catching up with atoms. Rather, atoms are catching up with bits, rather, in terms of ease of duplication. And that will only get easier and easier and better. And in terms of fabricating something that someone else has already designed, that's even more trivial. The design work's already been done, and you just kind of ask for a copy of it. And there's an ever-increasing array of fabrication techniques to create these objects. Ranging from, most of you guys already know, the Threat Wrap project. The one on the right is an electron beam melted part, which is pretty cool. You can make sort of aerospace grade components straight from the tab using this electron beam melting. It creates absolutely you can do metal sintering and have, you know, the blue one with SLS, the laser sintering, but they often had problems with having 100% density. If you slice through your object, you may have voids and flaws, although I think that's getting a lot better now. But this is pretty much 100% solid, pretty good. It's a sort of crappy system. And it's a little bit rougher. I mean, when I was first looking at this, I didn't really know much about the metal methods, and they weren't really on the market yet, as far as I was aware. So that was kind of a big thing that was missing. You know, how do you make metal parts straight from CAD? Obviously, you've got CNC, Fibex is CNC, but there are certain limitations in the geometry of what you can make in terms of internal complexity of the object, which you don't have with additive layered fabrication. And then I came across these guys first, and it's a reasonably quick process, although the resolution isn't, it's probably on par or maybe a little bit worse than polymer SLF, which is good for bio parts, because you want a rough surface for the body to, you've got a hip joint or something like that. It's really good for growing into it. And obviously you can post-process it as well, polish it, brilliant. But I saw fairly recently EOS's new SLS, EOS and M machines, and what they can do. And they are pretty special, actually. They have a wider range of materials, I think, than our can, which is their electron beam melting. And the resolution is 10 times better than their polymer sintering. It's really fine. They showed some parts of it in very, very intricate detail. And you would need very little post-processing, maybe a bit of shop cleaning or something like that. But it was pretty awesome. They showed they had an example of a mountain bike brake handle. One was solid, it was a stainless steel actually. And then they had another one which looked and felt like aluminium. You'd swear it was aluminium, but the CAD system that they'd done it on, they'd essentially done a kind of flood fill of a three-dimensional pattern inside the brake handle. So it was the same weight as an aluminium one. Obviously it's something that you can't do probably with any other process, because you have access to every single 3D point as you're building these things up. So, you know, it enables new geometry, new ways of building things, which is pretty cool. As it becomes generally used for prototyping, you know, these kinds of things, but is rapidly becoming a manufacturing method in its own way. So, what are the main methods for kind of getting this stuff made? From the simplest to kind of getting your hands dirty, and getting a group of guys to build it and craft it yourself, which is quite popular, and there's a lot of websites on the internet how to build stuff, videos and step-by-step tutorials. With somebody else's hands, get them dirty, a local engineering firm perhaps, specialising in certain techniques. Then there's the whole area of personal fabrications that is coming on stream, wrap fab at home, all that kind of thing. CNCing and various cheap material cutters of various different kinds. A step up would be a sort of fab lab, and I know Swaro's involved in the fab lab program, where in one room you have the capability of making, it depends on, presumably, are they all the same? I mean, there's probably differences. Is there a standard layout?
There's a standard set of
Right. But the plan I believe is to obviously be able to. Neil Gershenfeld is, I think, what I'm sort of saying. You should be able to go in there and be able to make an engine, and the engine management system to go with it, all the machinery in that one room, which is pretty cool. Along similar lines, as I touched on earlier, the mail order fabricators. Which is pretty amazing resource at the fingertips. I mean, e-machine shop has pretty much every machine under the sun. And then going up to contract manufacturing, you could imagine, the Oscar is not at a stage where you're going to do this yet, but maybe larger items, you could see in the transition period, maybe getting a lot of people together who want to order the same thing, at least the kind of base platform of a particular machine or product. And then taking use of economies of scale to, do a 25,000 order to a Chinese contractor, perhaps. And then you get the base model back that you can then customise to your own requirements. There's some interesting automated construction, getting larger scale again, emerging. There's basically rapid prototyping houses with sort of quick drying concrete. There's a process called contour crafting, which is being developed. I don't know if they've actually built a house yet. They keep claiming that they're about to. I don't know if they've actually done it, but it's a bit like FDM, which is squirting out molten polymer, rep, but it's kind of with quick drying concrete, which is pretty cool. So no house ever need look the same again. You can have curves in all axes, and even put in the services inside the walls as a building up, which is pretty awesome. And then kind of moving on ultimately to something I'm going to touch on in a second, which is a fully automated economy. So a whole kind of industrial infrastructure as well, so things that personal fabricators aren't able to do. Similar to what you could perhaps do with contract manufacturing. So when I say advanced automation, what I'm talking about here, in some sense personal fabricators are some kind of advanced automation, but what I'm talking about is industrial scale, no humans involved in the loop, self-repairing, self-maintaining machinery that has sensing, multiple sensing on every single component. The reason I've got that photograph on the right-hand side is that's Hitachi's new, it's called the new RFID tag, but it's 0.05 mil on the side. And that's basically, you can't really see it very well, but it's a test tube full of water and this, some people call it RFID powder, and it's so incredibly small. But that is an example of what's to come in terms of solid-state sensors. So you can imagine having sensors that are smaller than a grain of sand, for pressure, temperature, rotation, vibration, whatever it might be. So you can imagine having industrial machinery where the computer system monitoring it can see exactly what's going on everywhere, predict when failure is about to occur due to thermal differences, and you would have a kind of standard pattern coming from all the sensors when it's operation within normal bounds. be able to work out what was going wrong in many situations, just from all this advanced telemetry that you'd be getting from all this. And then you can imagine that if the system had a fully sort of three-dimensional model of where all the components sit with the standard installation, you can imagine that if something broke down, and you built it in such a way that it was easy for another machine to come along and repair it, because it was modular, you had cartridges. There are some racing motorbikes that have, you know, cartridge gearboxes that you can just swap out. But you can imagine critical components would use a similar system. So a robot could come along and swap out the parts, whether it was a single component, or perhaps if it didn't know exactly what the problem was, it could swap out some kind of sub-assembly. You could kind of imagine how that might work. The problem is at the moment that most machines, and especially industrial machinery, it's generally designed for humans to repair. Now you'd need artificial intelligence greater than we currently have and are likely to have in the very near future to have an autonomous machine that would be able to repair equipment that's designed for humans to repair. However, it wouldn't be that difficult to design the machine so it was repairable by another machine. Now that opens up, you know, enormous possibilities. It would make, for instance, the system ultimately scalable, because of course if it can totally repair and maintain itself, it can actually build itself as well. So if you wanted more capacity, that infrastructure in the factory or the power station, whatever it might be, would be able to increase capacity as well autonomously. So it would scale, and no humans being in the loop, there's no limit to the scaling, obviously just the kind of environmental impact and what we're actually trying to do. So it could potentially enable things that were just not previously possible, mega-scale engineering, all sorts of things like that. So that's what I mean by advanced automation. And in terms of what you might implement the advanced automation in, you know, everything from mining, material processing, large-scale energy generation, if you still need it, transport systems, environmental engineering. You know, there's no reason why we couldn't be terraforming on our own planet to sort things out. And there will be certain sophisticated manufacturing, you know, imagine making jet engines, that kind of thing. We're not generally going to do that in the background. Rockets, safety critical operations, and really large-scale fabrication, you know, ships, buildings, railways, that kind of thing. You can imagine that sort of system operating. So in terms of what's possible, what are we able to do, is rather dependent on our fundamental resources, which in the current economic framework, you know, a lot of people can identify some serious problems and limits and limitations. But the reality is that those limits are not necessarily there at all. It's a figment of our imagination. And the framework that we operate in at the moment. So the four basic ones are energy, material, information, and intelligence, as far as I can see. We'll find that, you know, the current world operates very inefficiently, and there's a lot of unnecessary complexity and chaos in the systems that run things. So we'll find that when we start operating open source, you know, advanced automation systems, a lot of that complexity would be swept away, and we'd be going back to first principles in terms of, can we do something? Well, does the material exist to do it, and do we have the energy to do it? And then in terms of intelligence, the guys, the systems and the machines to kind of carry out the operation, that's what I see as the limitations of what you're able to do, which is, there aren't many limitations really. There are so many. On my website, I've got a list of, you know, energy sources other than fossil fuels that we obviously currently rely on. But I mean, the main two. In fact, I've got a picture of one of them here. They're both solar. So, but from solar and geothermal alone, we could, at our current rate of energy use, could operate pretty much indefinitely. the whole core of our planet is molten. There's a whole lot of thermal energy locked up there. In terms of solar power, I forget the figures, it's something like 50,000 times the amount that we use in terms of power falls on the surface of the Earth. So people often say that, you know, we only have to harness a fraction of 1% of that. Now, in terms of material, again, we're not really very limited at all. If you take the top 20 most abundant elements in the Earth's crust and the sea and the atmosphere, that gives you pretty much everything that you need to make everything that mankind uses. There may be some odd vitamins that are required as well, but necessarily they're in small quantities. But, you know, food, medicine, houses, vehicles, robots, industrial machinery, computers, consumer goods. Bearing in mind Mr. Fuller's concept of ephemeralization, which is really just kind of being more efficient with what you've got, getting more functionality out of material that you've got, we'll constantly need less and less material as we get cleverer with how we create structure and everything else. You mentioned ephemeralization, I think, in your talk as well, didn't you? The other thing, of course, is that in terms of digging stuff out of the ground, if we actually are sensitive about how we design products, so they're designed for disassembly, they're designed to be autonomously broken back down to their constituent parts and elements, then you are massively reducing what you have to pull out of the ground and process. There's no reason, I don't believe, why you couldn't get up to 99%, tending towards 100% in terms of recycling of your material, which is a big, you know, a big point, really. I've got no idea whether it's going to work.
Outside of where the parts run.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, there are even methods of kind of turning organic material back into some kind of, the oil you were talking about, the pyrolysis, that there are various systems. There are various people who are working on pyrolytic processes for. There are various plastics as well, but we have probably reprocessing. But you could potentially take it back down to almost like its crude oil state, and then reprocess it again, potentially, depending on the energy. I'm just going to see if this page pops up. I just thought I'd bring you. It's quite interesting to see what those elements are. I think it is. So the kind of
which website is it?
This is. I'll give you the link at the end. This is my website that I've put together. So in terms of elements in the Earth's crust, in seawater and in the air, the most important one being this one. So oxygen, silicon, aluminium, iron, calcium, titanium, carbon, nickel. Most of the most important ones are in the top 20. And a notable exception being copper. but there's a hell of a lot. I mean, the copper, of course, is still there. All the copper we've mined has not vanished. It can be recycled. And I think the reality is, as time goes on in the coming decades, carbon is probably going to replace a lot of copper, in terms of carbon nanotubes with the right orientation of the lattice, are potentially better conductors than copper, electrical conductors. They're also better thermal conductors than copper as well, which is pretty good. Yeah, which is kind of a rare and problematic element, but there are carbon nanotube supercapacitors. MIT are working on electrolytic carbon nanotube supercapacitors with a vast surface area. So yeah, you can do. I think most things with that. it's just a list of. I mean, obviously, we're not going to run out of these things. You know, a lot of people think there's an issue with that, but there's simply not. And in terms of where you do dig stuff up, you know, if possible, you don't really want to be destroying nice landscape. You know, why can't we be digging these materials up from the abyssal plains, where it's thousands and millions of square kilometres of mud flats, and worms, and fairly similar ecosystems? If you have an automated mine, you know, on the abyssal plains, it's very localized. You know, is that the way to go? Maybe, I don't know. obviously, there's an increasing tendency towards distributed material processing, energy generation, all these things as well. But there's always a kind of way up between. You know, do you have a sort of centralized system, or you're always going to have a mixture of both, I think. Just going back to these fundamental resources, so intelligence, we obviously have human intelligence and machine intelligence. Human intelligence is something that maybe a lot of people think is in short supply, perhaps. I would argue that we're just not using it as effectively as we could be. The number of people that are collaborating with each other to do something significant is pretty small. It's pretty minimal, the number of people who are doing something useful, really. But that's going to improve. Education is becoming more pervasive, so that the brains that we do have are becoming more effective. There is an increasing number of brains. The population is still rising at the moment. Some people say, is a rising population, is that a problem, or is that part of the solution? Who knows what some people might come up with in terms of new ideas about what to do. And the kind of advanced automation which could potentially support a kind of open source world for people to do the things that they want to do. That's going to free up more brains to work on significant problems than sitting in an office doing the accounts or being a lawyer or an advertising executive, whatever it might be. There's a whole raft of jobs that are just going to become obsolete if this kind of happens. Machine intelligence, as we know, Moore's law, various other things, it's pretty much increasing exponentially the amount of processing that we have. I mean, I use the term machine intelligence fairly loosely. Obviously, we don't have. We have a lot of narrow AI, which is pretty good at what it does. You've got processing speed increasing. You've got the actual numbers of CPUs being produced increasing, and we're constantly improving algorithms and programming techniques. And so that's pretty much exponential, I would say as well. information, well, I mean that's obvious. It's the original post scarcity model. Information is the kind of post scarcity of post scarcity. In this day and age, it's just trying to find the good information, but we have plenty of mechanisms to let the good stuff rise to the top. And information, useful to both humans and the machine systems as well. So then we get on to, that's the basis for it, for what I would call a sort of post-scarcity era. What do I mean by scarcity? Samari, you used a term, non-exotic goods or products, I think. Similarly, I mean, I call it significant scarcity, which is pretty much the same thing. The things that actually matter, food, housing, medicine, all the stuff you need to sustain yourself. All the needs, plus many or most of the wants. Obviously, there are certain limitations as to where you can live and various other things. But that's what I'm talking about here, significant scarcity. you know, gold 15th century masters paintings. You know, they don't, do they matter to me in my existence? No, I have no use for them whatsoever. If there's a veneer of an economy still there with people trading rare goods and items, fine. I mean, let them do it. That's not a problem. With this model that I'm talking about here, I don't see a free rider issue. I see it very very similar to the open source software model, where you know something like Firefox, you know, you download binary. It doesn't matter how many people use it. It doesn't matter to the developers that you know a million people are using it. As long as we're not totally destroying, as long as we're doing it intelligently, we're not destroying the planet in terms of what we make as we do. I don't think it's going to be a problem with people having things that they want. And a lot of the time, we'd be much smarter about when people no longer want things. There will be other people who want the things that you no longer want. And you know, it may be that it turns out to be reasonably easy to kind of refurbish those same products. You know, to clean them up and to you know, either replace worn components, you know, as a fairly automatic process. So I don't see the free ride issues being much of a problem there. what is potentially a problem is the transition period, which I've mentioned there. You know, there could be, yeah, who knows how it might turn out. And in terms of the societal, the political, the various other fallout, you know, one cannot predict what humanity is going to do there when we get to that transition. I think it, you know, it can't be, it won't be too quick. You know, unless we get human level AI plus more, you know, a singularity event, but you know, we can get to that. We can get to this before we get to that, I think, probably. And an important point is that what we're talking about here, you know, advanced nanotechnology simply is not required, which I find interesting because, you know, the sort of rapture of the geeks in terms of what's going to be possible with advanced nanotech, a hell of a lot of that is going to be possible before we even have nanotech. Everything that we make now, you know, we don't use advanced nanotechnology at all. So those same systems can be produced with the open source development model, machine systems, everything else. You know, nanotech is not required. So a lot of guys think we've got to wait for the nanotech revolution for post-scarcity to happen, which I don't believe is the case at all. There are certain things we can't do if you have nanotech, whereas medicine and various things. But, all things that we currently do, we can do. And with technology that we have now, know-how and technology that we have today, I think there's very little that we actually need to develop that we haven't been able to develop and understand, at least at the sort of research level, to implement this kind of thing. Another thing that I find very interesting is that what we're talking about here, I think, is happening from two totally different directions at the same time, merging at the same point, which is potentially the open source hardware development model, when that kind of kicks off properly, we've got the right tools. That'll be coming from one angle. But the commercial ecosystem, which is constantly competing with each other, you are tending towards zero in terms of cost for everything. You know, whether it's mining operations, whether it's producing products, with the constant competition, you are ultimately tending towards zero. So, whichever route, both routes in parallel, I personally think that it's inevitable, unless there's kind of some kind of strange political or artificial scarcity imposed. I see that as being inevitable. Yeah, and I was just going to mention Joseph Jackson's journal as well. Partly on my website, gathering stuff together. I don't know. I need to talk to him actually. I don't know where he's got to with that, but he's planning to create a journal of post scarcity studies, just to kind of get these memes spread a bit further and work out some of the detail. So that's in the very early stages at the moment. That's his initiative. I don't know what I'm probably a bit early, but that's just another summary. That's my website where I've kind of put together all these ideas, attempting to make a sort of holistic whole. There's a site map here, which has got it all mapped out, sort of hierarchical, all the parts. There's also, can't see it here, but there's a kind of tour. There are tour buttons at the bottom of the main page which you can follow for detailed or just a quick overview. And that's my website, if anyone is still there. There we go. Any questions or comments? They're pretty early stage, really, I would say. There are some packages where you can generate geometry and you could probably just about do what you need to do, but it's pretty clunky. But I think we're probably at that tipping point now where a lot of the components needed to put something like that together is becoming increasingly easy to do. So I think we've probably just kind of got over that hump, and there's a lot of projects now. There's a hell of a lot of projects, compared to 2 years ago, that have been started and they're working on.
So all the machine shops I've seen so far using their proprietary solution. From my perspective, it makes sense for them to actually push that. Because if the first of them could really offer an open source tool set,
would
probably be used by much more projects.
And they can all share resources and help push that further. Everyone who's got an interest in that. I think it's going to come fairly soon, really. I am actually working on a project along those lines, but the guys who are potentially going to get some funding for it don't want me to talk about it at the moment, so, which is a shame, because it would be an interesting thing to talk about. But it's coming pretty soon. But I think it's important for the end user to have a single application that has most of the functionality you need built in to make it really simple to connect to other people, see what's going on, import other projects, and really sort out the graphical interface for CAD systems, which have always historically been pretty poor in terms of usability. I work for a product design company. I'm not a heavy CAD user myself, but some of these CAD jockeys who do it all day every day, with these top end, Unigraphics and various things, they kind of struggle to get what they imagine into a 3D model. It's still clunky. There's an enormous amount of evolution you can do on the user interface, which would, if you have an open source project, if you have the software designed in a nice modular manner to enable other people to do plugging and extensions and experiment. I think there'll be a big speed up of evolution of that kind of software. So that can only be a good thing.
Question regarding this project. Do you think there's still need a lot of knowledge on how you use to construct 3D models? Need the others of the user interface?
It's not trivial, but I think the systems to guide the user to get them to what they want to do, and making use of stuff that other people have already created, is going to significantly improve things. There's no limit to the sophistication of how it can hold your hand through the process. As long as that keeps evolving, that'll get easier and easier. And I think, once you start, if you're not a CAD user, if you start playing with this stuff, it's really easy just to import other people's models and just rotate them, play with them, remove components, just mess around with it, maybe change the colours, do some very basic tweaking, and then get these things made, and then you go, wow, that's fantastic. okay, well, you know, next time I'm going to do a few little tweaks and just see how this works, and kind of get them into it. It's all about kind of lowering the barrier for entry. Really.
For me, it's been the best 2 years for having been because they're so simple that people can find easy.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the end of the day, what I feel at least in most is the ability to talk to you how to hand. You know, if
yes.
One piece of software, a software machine.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you see that?
What software, some of the tasks of the designing as well, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also the automation.
Well, I mean, I imagine we're kind of, you know, the next step, you know, in terms of slickness will be having, you know, all machinery is kind of accessible through the network, through the internet, as a, you know, as a printer might be in an office. But your CAD software is able to interface with it and give you the right interface to do what you need to do with that machine. And having the right kind of, you know, abstraction layers and communication interfaces. I think it'll just evolve and improve to where we need it to go. It'll just be a steady iterative process, I think. And then, you know, obviously the software itself will become more capable. It's undoubted that at some point, you know, you'll have sort of evolutionary algorithms doing all sorts of interesting design. Hod Lipson, who's the guy, one of the guys behind the Fab at Home project, did some really interesting stuff with robotic locomotion, different configurations of limbs and actuators and that kind of thing, which he evolved over many generations. And obviously, you know, he put in some starting conditions and various things to kick off. But he let it run, and then, you know, the solutions that best met his criteria at the end of it, he would then print out on the rack of prototypes and then use the standard actuated components that were kind of being simulated and put them together and to see how they... which is a very early example, but quite a cool experiment.
Well, there's actually a thing with
power
machines working on this collection from the
Yeah, proprietary stuff. You know, we need, you know, obviously there's a catch up to, you know, get on par with the commercial systems as well, before you start getting the kind of innovation within the open source software itself. But what I think is really powerful is that, you know, as I say, I work for a sort of product design company, an engineering company. Particular products in a commercial setting, A, you've obviously got a limited number of engineers and developers. And, you know, say you've got 4 different product lines, they're evolved, serially, you know, maybe every 18 months or 2 years or whatever it is. You know, each of those lines is kind of iterated along a kind of pretty much a single path. So it's incredibly slow, but you can imagine when the open source side of it really kicks off, you know, you'd have some stable kind of platform designs. Designs that people can use as a starting point, and you know they will be evolved, you know, in 1,000 different directions at once, and you'll get this incredible Darwinian evolution of new products and things, and you know some won't work and they'll hit a dead end, but you'll get so much going on at the same time. I mean, it would be mind. I think the progress of machines and systems is going to would just explode. Did you have a question earlier?
Say what?
Did you have a question earlier?
I
think you were saying you
did. Yeah, no, it's a longer discussion, but I wanted to see, well, how do we bring the people together to make it happen? Face to face, you know, the people get from this conference, what can we do?
Yeah, I think it's a matter.
Have you guys had any plans of some conferences? Or, that's, I think, what we should really
hear that. I mean, this is just me, really, at the moment. I mean, I'm kind of independent, but, you know, we're all part of this kind of wider network.
Yeah, like Joseph Jackson, he's from Wood Miller, he's going to come to our place, actually, for the summer.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that would be a great place to host it.
Yeah, I mean, what I would like to see is we come together for a crash course, like maybe a month, and all of us do some due diligence before we come and build the things. You know, I can do building, and if other people have skills, we can build stuff. But if we could get funding, if we could get professionals involved, and just have the people just knock it off, be done with it. I mean, all it would take is, like, I don't know, like 50K, it would be enough, probably be close for the whole basic package that I talked about. That would be probably more than enough to knock it all off, the whole thing off, for a fraction of the existing fab left, and having much more capacity.
Yeah.
You know?
One of the things that I've been working on with Hashim, and you know, I only realized now that we're in a relationship, is after Joseph Jackson came up with this idea of a Christoph Steen research group, sort of thinking that what we should be doing is getting a bunch of people who are, you know, doing the work for interviews, who are like the people who are likely to contribute to that kind of thing, and create this kind of autocratic, like distributed faculty of Christoph Steen researchers. As a for on the one hand getting that kind of funding that Hashim was talking about, and also as a method of getting back in the community to take a seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've spoken to, part of my job actually, which is quite interesting, is looking at stuff emerging out of universities that we could make use of.
Resources that exist in universities, you said?
Yeah, you know, just going looking at research that is, you know, we could potentially use in products and that kind of thing. And, you know, a lot of academics, you know, I talk to them quite a lot, you know, it kind of sits well with a lot of the way that they think, their philosophies and the way they work. Obviously, yeah, academics are, you know, often big supporters of open source software anyway, with the freedom it gives. But I think, I don't think it would take much encouragement to get all sorts of interesting guys in academia to get involved in this kind of thing. So we just need to kind of get our shit together and, you know, make it look like a sort of serious effort, I suppose. Done. So this is as I see it, you know, you may disagree with various aspects of it, but, you know, feel free to comment, discuss anything.
Maybe just talk about the conference or getting together to the phone call the plenary session afterwards. Just bring it out there and then so at least it's not a good idea. I have one more technical question. For all the traffic holders, they use some sort of raw materials. What are these raw materials?
But it totally depends on what they are, you know.
Yeah.
A CNC machine will be using a block of metal. All the rapid prototypes all seem to use totally different sort of polymer systems from each other. Perhaps RepRap will standardize that. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, some of the RepRap guys are looking at some much simpler stuff to extrude, you know, other more advanced engineering polymers. That's right, yeah, which is the standard commercial FDM material, which is pretty robust. That's right, and some crash helmets, and so it's pretty tight. Some of the layered fabrication techniques produce fairly brittle, non-functional components, really. But you know, there are a few, you know, SLS. SLS is pretty strong. You know, when we test SLS, it's not too different from the stuff that we actually produce for real. And then an FDM as well is pretty robust, so you can use them as functional components. There are a lot of just kind of visual processing technologies. But FDM is a good old-fashioned usable one, which is good. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think we'll include every material that you know, used by mankind, and you know, the initial material processing step, you know, when that becomes kind of automated and open. And once we get sort of national infrastructure kind of under the open source development model, you know, you can imagine the kind of efficiencies and innovation that could potentially occur in those areas. You know, much more joined up thinking. You know, if you imagine, you know, companies, you know, refining materials and various other, I mean, obviously within their own kind of company portfolio and what they do, they try and maximize efficiency of stuff. But you know, you could do that on a national and global scale in terms of, you know, the waste products that companies get rid of that actually are perfectly usable by other people. There's so much joined up thinking that could be done if it was done this way. I mean, you know, every time I think about it, you know, the more you think about these things, the more they do fundamentally kind of make sense. The whole pack of things just makes total sense. You know, there are some crazy ideas you have, and you think about it a while, and you kind of iterate it a bit. And then you realise there are some glaring flaws that are quite like, okay, that's not possible. But I mean, the more I think about this and talk to people about this and everything else, instead of more problems appearing, you know, I see it as being more and more viable and obvious, which I think a lot of people seem to be coming to the same conclusion. So, that's what we're going to do, I think.
Yeah, I could come out and I think steel base, I mean, that's iron, one of the very modern things, is very much a blend of all the extractors that are available. If we propose to melt down and increase the neutralization, and then down the road, I would say that aluminum, because aluminum silicates for clay are everywhere.
Mm. It's about the fourth most abundant element, I think.
Yeah, or like second most abundant.
Yeah, that's
the third. Yeah, it was way up there. It's everywhere. We're talking on our farm, and we're doing that down the road, and we're processing the energy to do it. So we've been demonstrating this advanced civilization in 4 years, which is enough anyway.
We also are attempting to that raw materials are not problems.
It's also about changing people's perceptions as to what is possible. That's the educational side of it as well. My thinking really behind this was that it was so hard for me to have conversations with people because it's so wide ranging. You know, they've fallen asleep after the first half an hour, and you've only explained 1/10 of the whole picture, and then they keep saying, "Oh, well, no, you can't do that because of X, Y, and Z." But that was something that you were going to explain later before they fell asleep, you know. So I put this together to try and, you know, so I could send people links, and I've tried to lay it out in the simplest, you know, it's almost like a kid's storybook, really, trying to just get these ideas across in the simplest manner possible, in the simplest language.
Is that media?
Yeah.
Hey, what about... Okay, do you see resistance from the system as it is? Because, I mean, you could have abundance right now, but
Okay,
there's power flows that prevent that.
Yeah.
Are the systems going to be addressed?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I think that they are, you know, they will not be well organized enough for a start. Governments are transitory, countries are inherently competitive with each other. They will never be able to get their shit together. To mount a significant resistance, I don't think. Of course.
They will slow up the process.
Say it again?
They will slow up the process.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. Because that's the incumbent system.
So, my comment is going to be that, like I say, I don't see the technological or technical problems being
no.
an issue.
No, absolutely.
The issue is going to be the people.
Of course it is, and I haven't really even touched on that. And there's so many things that I could have spoken about as well, you know, agriculture. There's a whole thing I've missed out, but the political, you know, the social and political aspects of the... I mean, it's managing that transition period that really is one of the big challenges, not necessarily the technology.
The good news is that all the stuff was topped out from capitalism so far.
Yeah.
I mean, there are groups of capital which are interested in this kind of stuff.
Yes.
And so within a different software, where you have some groups inside that building which are...
They all want this because they need it for doing the other things that they do.
So it's a business model for them.
So being clever about how you harness the existing capital system to help make it happen as well. Yes, but it's the same in software, you know, is that any different to the software?
Yes, look at how capitalism came about. I mean, the Lords used capitalism for their things. Yeah. But at some point, they were replaced by capitalism, so why shouldn't we be responsible for it?
And I think what we've got to remember is that, you know, humanity is a fluid thing. You know, there aren't these guys who are now in the current incumbent system. They're not always going to be in that system. They will be people who will happily jump across when they see the benefits from it. So it's not totally black and white, but there will always be these people here resisting. And I think in general, the system that causes the resistance, the incumbent systems that cause resistance, you know, you can totally understand from their point of view why they do it. But I don't believe that there is some, you know, massive kind of conspiracy to keep various things undercover. Yes, they can make life difficult at certain points in time, but in the grand scale of time, it's not significant, I don't think.
I don't think we talk about significant amount of time. I think in 30, 40, I think in 40 years we'll be using real energy. Already
less than it should be.
Less. For example, Portugal, they using tidal energy, and I think that the exact percentage, but I think it's going to be one of the first countries going to be completely using renewable energy, and now it's really high.
That one's powering most of Seville, I gather. You have the concentration gradient.
So basically the solid water touches the touch protocol and use that as well.
Right.
Really?
And you can extract significant energy for that.
Yeah. It's just like a hydroelectric power plant localized in one place.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing.
The energy is really a big deal.
Absolutely.
You know, like Stockholm is about the ocean.
But it's a matter of education now, isn't it, really? People think materials, energy, you know, they think they're big problems, but they're just not.
That's how to get across to all these guys who have this environmental thing.
Yeah, but, you know, if they're thinking within the kind of current economic framework, where the cheapest and easiest thing to do is to pump oil out of the ground, it's very hard for them to understand and think beyond that framework. That is really difficult. So we've got to do a good kind of PR and education effort, apart from anything else, which, you know, the journal will help. Stuff for a wider audience. There's so much we could do. I think.
Getting into patent versus the property problems might come across, because I mean, you can't even build a pen today without writing any type of patents. It's much harder than the software running. In Europe, you don't have so many software patents.
Yeah.
Everything you could possibly do with a lot of patents, actually.
At the kind of beginning stage, it's obviously going to be potentially a problem. However, in the UK, you can make stuff for your personal use that potentially could happen. It's only if you sell something. There's nothing to stop you making.
What's the situation for machine shops or contract shops? If you contract them,
yeah, I don't know. It's a grey area. I don't know enough about the legal side of that.
I mean, they probably have thought about it. They probably have something in terms of use that, you know, allow the sentiment thing with mining, blah, 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 and the internet store.
Yeah, or maybe it's, you know, maybe it's a bit like some file sharing networks where it's the individuals who get, you know, the legal action taken against them. You know, it's a bit like sort of storing storing sort of illegal or other people's digital property on someone's servers. You know, other guys actually hosting that. They don't know what's being hosted. You know, that's a bit like the fabricators. Maybe they're not in a position to be vetting every single thing that they make. It's probably not their job. I think it's down to the groups and the individuals. And of course, when you have this stuff starts going to the home, which is obviously going to happen, following a similar pattern to printers, which are very expensive in business, and they're all working for them, you can't really stop. People are just going to do it. I think it's just going to. It's just no one's going to give a shit, really, ultimately. But it's a good point. Good point. I mean, in a lot of situations, I mean, it may be that the patent process actually collapses before we get, because actually there are a lot of companies who would like to see it not be there, probably more than do who want it there. So there's a lot of pressure from all sides to kind of perform that kind of thing. But I think it'll just become it'll just become irrelevant, I think, at some point in time. Yeah, that's potentially a
discussion about how
and how to protect or how to sort of enable the copyleft mechanism to work properly and stop companies, you know, making stuff that's being produced and selling it. But I'm not sure. I mean, at the end of the day, if you produce something that's effectively open source or public domain, does it matter if a company in the transition period takes it and builds it efficiently? It only means that you're going to be able to get that thing cheaper in that transition period. So I think that's the way I look at it. I think that kind of just helps. And of course, if they then build upon it and keep it proprietary, hardware, machines, you know, they're far easier to reverse engineer than some, you know, compiled software. You know, you can see how it works. You can then rip them off again. You know.
One of those.
No. I'm talking about sort of mechanical systems. Yeah. But
chips are actually a very good point because they are very hard to fabricate. You need a lot of machines. You know, when you come to land, you have to have chips out from the
company. Yeah. Yeah, you still got to make the FPGAs there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The question is always what kind of chips. I mean, there are techniques which could do some flexible chips. I think this would be feasible for the home, but for the very complex chips, which like CPUs or so, really highly technical.
Yeah.
Very,
I think if you look at the past or the way these things work, is that very often new technologies come along which sweep away the complexity and the difficulties of pre-methods,
yeah.
And it just gets swept away. So, you know, whether it was some kind of, you know, self-assembling protein-based system that you could do in the kitchen, you know.
You know that
sort of stuff. Yeah, you know, maybe genetically altered organisms that are actually able to fabricate. You know, they're almost like biological nanotech. Yeah, who knows what's going to happen? But I think it's only going to get simpler and easier, and that's always the trend, isn't it?
For these systems.
That turns out to be reasonably easy, actually. Yeah. It's the conditions for it are well known and well understood. I mean, they generally use plasma CVD. But in the right conditions, they're incredibly easy to make. You just need nickel or iron catalyst, which you have at high temperatures, and you have a hydrocarbon gas, carbon containing gas, and the carbon will dissolve into the catalyst and become supersaturated, and then it will just get to the point where it just spits out carbon nanotubes. They just self-assemble in milliseconds straight from this catalyst. They're actually reasonably easy to make. They're just working out, you know, the parameters to kind of scale it up. There's so much work going on there. They will be so cheap to manufacture at some point, and it's going to be incredibly abundant. And it's not. It turns out it's not very difficult to make. There's no exotic materials required, like iron or nickel for the catalyst.
Okay, I think we should stop here, so I'm going to start the training session at 11, which will be more or less about me. I try to, I don't know why that works.
Good, well, thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
It's very impressive.